Hi, everyone. This is Dev Propulsion Labs, our podcast about the business of developer tools. And my name is Victoria Melnikova. I'm head of new business at Evil Martians, and I'm very excited to meet today's guest, Jeff Huber, co-founder and CEO at Chroma. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, how are you?
I'm great. How are you?
Doing wonderful, thanks.
I'm actually very excited to record today's episode because I'm hosting you, but you're hosting me. We're at Chroma's office here in the heart of San Francisco, and I'm very excited to pick Jeff's brain about what's going on with Chroma. So who is Jeff?
Well, I've worked now for something like 10 years in applied machine learning and developer tools. And, you know, this is back before we called it AI and certainly not Gen AI. It was really just a deep learning. And, I think I've always wanted to like find places to build really great tools. And I like love the leverage that building really great tools enables. And obviously open source in particular is even like a further accelerant of that. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, one kind of like theory of mind, I guess, you know, I'm not laying down, you know, this is not a psychiatric session, but some, you know, theory of mind of Jeff might triangulate on those things. And, you know, kind of just connect that to like the Chroma story a little bit. You know, Chroma started basically because I had worked in applied machine learning for 10 mm-hmm. years and just like seen how challenging it was to build production systems with AI and machine learning. And, you know, these systems seem to hold a lot of promise, you know, could or should they be made reliable enough to be trusted? But like, that was always just such a really challenging thing to figure out, and still is today, obviously. And, you know, I think kind of classic, there must be a better way, was sort of the thesis. And so that was one part of it. And then the other part of it was that at the time, at least that we started, you know, nobody really knew what latent space was. Mm-hmm. You know, embeddings were not really a concept that very popularized. And so, you know, we had seen some research and we kind of had an intuition that like the viewing data in high dimensionality, the way that models like see their own data, mm-hmm. had a lot of promise to interpretability, being able to understand like how and why these systems are doing certain things. Mm-hmm. And also, you know, therefore also had a lot of promise to being able to sort of deterministically iterate and improve these systems as well. And so, you know, this is very much a hunch. We didn't necessarily have evidence, direct evidence before starting the company that was going to work. And then of course, the world kind of shifted something like 6 months kind of into the company. And now of course, like saying like embeddings are good or valuable or useful sounds like hilariously obvious. But at the time, I think like, you know, the vast majority of VCs that we sort of pitched and, you know, said this to, just like their eyes glazed over and they had no idea what we were talking about. And so, yeah.
You're kind of reshaping what's going on, right? I was just on the call with Saud from Klein and he said that RAG doesn't exist. So like, what is the premise of Chroma? And we can talk a bit more about the Chroma, like what it offers to, you know, users.
Yeah,
how are you shifting the narrative, basically?
Yeah, I mean, I think like, you know, RAG is, you know, the king is dead, long live the king. You know, the reports of my death have been greatly exaggerated. Like all these like phrases apply so well to RAG. You know, the irony is that, you know, the Klein team seems to have found, and I will, you know, I give them crap on the internet for this. I'm happy to, you know, give them crap on the record here as well. You know, they say they don't use RAG and yet they literally give their agents the ability to regex and grep the repo. And like last I checked, that is retrieval augmented generation. Yes, it is not like single dense vector search, but like nobody has ever said that that is a panacea. And that's kind of like a false boogeyman, in my opinion. I do think that like the narrative has shifted in the last few months from mm-hmm. like RAG to context engineering, which I've both been a part of proliferating that concept. And like, I think is a very positive shift. RAG like never meant anything to anybody. And as a result, meant everything to everybody as well. And like, it's just overall a poor phrase to help shape the actual job to be done versus context engineering is a great phrase and implies the existence of a context engineer, which is literally the job of like most AI teams today. Like your job is not to fine tune the model. Your job is to figure out how to engineer the context window such that the model can be successful at the job you need to be good at. And so I think it's like a very positive change. Now, search and retrieval is a, you know, extremely ubiquitous and important tool in solving the challenges of context engineering. But yeah, I think RAG overall, I mean, you know, most of what you see on Twitter is like brain rot and, you know, just sort of bad for your soul and hype. And so maybe we should all log off and touch grass more. I think, you know, anybody who has like very extreme claims that also demands extreme evidence And I never see any evidence from any of these claims. So
let's pause here for a second. When we talk about context engineering, I mean, you and I, we kind of exist in the bubble of the Bay Area, right? All of those things make a lot of sense. But if we talk to an average engineer globally, what does context engineering mean?
Yeah. So really one way to think about like what LLMs are, you know, some people, you know, mainly the large language model labs they want you to believe in artificial and superintelligence. They want you to believe that AI is this like literal deus ex machina. It is a god that is going to come out of the machine. It is going to solve all of humanity's problems. And listen, if I had to raise $100 billion, I would absolutely be telling you like the same thing. I think that is like not actually what AI is though. And like AI is really just a new era of computing. Mm-hmm. That's a new way of building software. Classic computers are very good at running structured programs with structured inputs and outputs. Mm-hmm. And LLMs are very good at running unstructured programs with unstructured inputs and outputs. And, you know, then you sort of ask yourself the question, well, you know, you sort of pass, you know, code, you know, to a CPU to run a program, kind of classic computing. And in AI, you pass a context window to an LLM or to a visual language model to be processed. And so, you know, you think about the context window, that is the tool, that is your programming canvas. And, you know, if you put bad stuff in there, the model will get distracted or get overwhelmed or get it wrong. If you put good stuff in there, the model has a fighting chance to get it right. Mm-hmm. And so like the job then becomes figuring out again, like what goes into the context, mm-hmm. because that is how you sort of set the behavior and you program the system. And, you know, this problem is like not as easy as it may first appear. You know, we released a technical report a few months back that has kind of gone far and wide on the internet on the topic of context rot, which is looking at how the both ability of models to pay attention to and the ability of models to reason over their inputs degrades as the sort of context window increases in size. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, models might be marketed as having like a million tokens of context, and yet, mm-hmm. like, you know, real builders who are building them to do things that are difficult, you know, usually don't trust them once they pass like 40,000 tokens or something like this. Mm-hmm. And so like, you know, there's a bunch of techniques then you can employ to work around these constraints. But this is the job of context engineering. You know, you, a smart person, if you have the tools of programming available to you and you can vibe code the rest, you know, need to figure out basically, again, like, how do I curate the right mixture of information, mm-hmm. such that the model has a very good chance of producing the outcome that I want, mm-hmm. and doing so reliably, right? Not just doing so one time, but handling, you know, the real world's a pretty messy place. Unstructured data has a tendency to sort of, you know, mug systems, if you will, and mm-hmm. you get mugged by reality, and reality is factually complex. Mm-hmm. And so like, this is also, I think, like part of the challenge of context engineering is like, how do I build systems that are sort of very reliable at the limit and aren't just, you know, reliable 7 times out of 10, but reliable 99.999999 times out of 10. So
Chroma's positioning, and I want to read it because I don't want to butcher it, is an AI native open source embedded database. What does it mean in 2025?
The phrasing that I would use maybe like today is, I see very much what we're working on is building modern search infrastructure, mm-hmm. for AI. Modern is mostly in contrast to legacy, mm-hmm. search infrastructure, which is very costly, very difficult to scale, very difficult to run. It doesn't have a lot of advanced features that you would want for AI versus a modern distributed system, mm-hmm. which is effortless to scale, effortless to run, very cost effective, very, mm-hmm. fast. And then the for AI part, it was many different facets, but I'll give you kind of one conjecture. You know, today it may still be the case that human queries, mm-hmm. sort of, you know, outnumber AI queries. Yeah. But you can imagine in 2 years, that's going to be a million to one on the side of AI. And so like, you know, AI is by far the most important user of search, both obviously submitting search queries, but also digesting search results. Yeah. And I think that also like motivates and necessitates a lot of things at the infrastructure layer to support that large secular shift in how search works, or search and retrieval work. And so like, that's the problem that we're working on, is, yeah. really building a whole like suite of like both data tools, compute tools, platform tools around enabling teams to solve those kinds of problems.
So you founded Chroma a few years ago, right? In 2022, mm-hmm. if, mm-hmm. I'm not mistaken. Mm-hmm. And since then, has your positioning shifted a lot? Or let's say later in 2024, 2025, do you feel like you had to adjust the positioning, mm-hmm. a lot because of this upcoming wave?
My disposition is always, I think that the best companies are quite fixed on the long-term future. So like where they want to be in 10 years, like rarely changes. Like, you know, maybe occasionally something massive happens that totally changes where the company should be in 10 years. But like at most time, you can kind of actually seeing 10 years forward is like not that hard. Also seeing like a month into the future, it's like not that hard. You kind of have all the information, you know. I think that like the death zone for predictions is generally in the 2 to 3 year period. Because it's sort of hard to know, you know, again, you know where you are, you know, we're going to get there, but like the path to get there
is not linear.
Yeah. You don't know. Right. And like, you know, you might need to go that way and then that way. And so like, it kind of depends on the market. And like, yeah. I think, you know, the founders that also are very, let's not use the word reactive, but are like sensitive, like to the market and are like only wanting to work on things and like productize and commercialize things that like their users really care about. And like, that's ultimately the goal to grow fast is you have to do things people care about. And so like, it's fine to build a feature that's really important in 10 years, but if nobody cares about it today, then you sort of just like wasted your time.
Yeah.
Maybe unless it's going to take you 10 years to build it. And so I think we're very willing to like, you know, sort of massage the like positioning to like reach our ICP in a way that they understand and the way that they're excited about. But I don't think that's at the expense of like the long-term vision.
This is so interesting. And actually the 10-year mark is coming up, right? It's like in 5-6 years at this point. So what is Chroma in 5 years?
Again, going back to like the founding of the company, like the goal of Chroma has from the start been to enable developers to somewhat deterministically and easily build production systems. And I think that comes through continual learning. Ultimately, this is the goal of, I think, building very reliable AI systems, ones that deal, you know, very well at the edges of their domain knowledge. Is like they have to deal well with the edge cases. They have to build an intuition for how to deal with edge cases. You know, you and I can like walk into a new, you know, job or environment and somebody can teach us how to do something very quickly, actually. And then we can like generalize and pattern match and apply that to new scenarios. And like, you know, maybe we do something wrong and the person sitting next to us says, hey, next time do this, sort of like this apprenticeship model. And like, we can kind of build up a corpus of like tacit knowledge in our brains. And then like, we're actually good at that job. And we do get to that like 99.9999% reliability that like is so desirable. And like, and then enables other people to trust us and everything else. And so like, we want our like machine systems to have that like same ability to like get better over time. People call this continual learning. And, you know, what tools do you have available to you for an AI system to make it better over time? You can change the prompt, like the system prompt. You can change the weights of, you know, one or many models, you know, kind of in the stack. And then you can change like the data the model has access to. And likely it's the case that like all of these things you want to change to get the most, you know, reliability. I'd say most of our customers today, you know, are not yet like in the business of like fine tuning the models. I think that was like kind of not a great idea for many years. It does feel like that's maybe starting to change actually. Prompt optimization has become like much, much more popular, which is really exciting. You see projects like DSPy popularizing methods like JEPA, which you can do like automated prompt optimization, which is like really awesome. And then obviously like, A lot of our customers both use Chroma for just like traditional static RAG or kind of knowledge bases, corpuses, et cetera. But like increasingly, we're starting to see customers use Chroma also from memory broadly. And like memory, I don't love that word, but like broadly what memory means is like the intuition here is you want the system to be able to like continually get better over time. And that could be either getting better at a given task. And obviously there's one, well, I guess always a given task. One such task is user personalization. And so like it could be, you know, the model is getting better at talking to you, the model is getting better at doing this kind of a task or both. And so that's like, I would say a fast growing use case kind of in our customer set is like memory broadly. And so again, this is all in our minds, like in the direction of like continual learning. And I hope that in 5 years, we've just like fully solved that problem for the majority of like business use cases.
Interesting. I want to talk about business for a little bit. So I think I saw in one of your interviews that one of the early hires was a designer. Am I wrong on that?
Yeah.
So it's not common for databases to pay so much attention to design and finesse. And if one goes to your website, they will see that there is a lot of attention to detail and it's very polished. It's not common in developer tools. Now I think it's becoming more common, but it's admirable. So for you in making that decision, what was the thinking? How do you justify that kind of investment early on, considering that ROI from that is not apparent? Basically take us through your reasoning there.
I mean, I probably would want to invest in design, even if it didn't change the bottom line, mm-hmm. just because I have to live a certain way and I like mm-hmm. couldn't sleep at night if like it all sucked, you know? You know, there's like, and to be clear, like brutalist design is still design, right? Yeah. And so like, you know, a web page with only Times New Roman 12-point font, black text on a white background, that's still design. So that's not, I'm not saying that that's anti-design, right? But if it looked ugly, I just like could not live with myself. And so like it has to sort of, for my own, you know, estimation, be beautiful. Broadly speaking, I would say engineers and developers tend to have more of a blind spot when it comes to the importance of brand. And obviously, like the opposite of this is like, you know, consumer packaged good companies in New York or LA, right? Like they're 100% brand. And then it's just like a product they buy off Alibaba, right? Like it's like all brand. But like, I will say that like in practice, the number of people that like have a positive association with Chroma and like say to me, like, I love the design of your website,
yeah.
like is many. And that feels accretive and long-term valuable and important. Mm-hmm. And so I think in that way, like for developer tools companies, like design can be like a bit of a moat as well, because I mean, brand is, you know, is a very useful thing to build. If you need great design to build brand, then you also need to be able to have a good design culture. You need to be able to hire great designers, you know, like manage and lead great designers. And like, that is sort of a difficult thing to do very, very well. And so like, you know, anything that you can do very well that your users and users care about that is difficult to do is something that like, you know, increases the chances of your project being more successful. And obviously for open source, like, you know, commercial open source, like success is both defined by like the number of customers who are users who are just using your product out there in the world. And then like jointly the number of customers that are using, you know, your managed services or whatever the revenue model is. And I think that like any, you know, commercial open source founder or even just open source project maintainer that really cares about impact, you know, like more users is better in a way, right? Like more users means that your project is having more of an impact on the world. And I think it's like something that we all, you know, desire deep down is to have an impact on the world.
This is very exciting to hear. And I'm reflecting on this kind of level of perfectionism and attention to detail that mm-hmm. you yourself portray. But when it comes to hiring team members, is that something that you're actively looking for in people that you would hire at Chroma?
We have a pretty well-honed kind of hiring process. And I think it's something like for every 100 phone screens, we have one accepted offer,
mm-hmm.
like sort of top of funnel, like bottom of funnel. It would be bad to just sort of like, you know, throw lots of low quality candidates into the pipeline to make that number even more dramatic, obviously. So there's like a moral hazard here to like these sorts of ratios, if you will. But like, and that's not because everybody that we interview, you know, isn't, you know, really smart or really good at what they do. At times, it's also just like not a cultural fit. And I think like we really have a culture of people who do like sweat the details. And I can just tell you like right now, some of the things that we're working on, they're being sort of in private beta right now or releasing soon. Like, the amount of time that we put into like API design is like, I have not seen anywhere else that maybe other people do this, but like we will have like all team meetings, which, you know, as far as meetings go are very expensive
yeah.
for like an hour or an hour and a half
yeah.
to everybody comes into a room. We all look at the API. We all nitpick the API. We all use the API. We try to find all the sharp edges of the API. Yeah. We just like, we are obsessed with like making like the very best APIs possible. And like, mm-hmm. you know, get names will have like 18 different variants,
mm-hmm.
you know, like what is the actual, you know, collection dot name or, you know, client dot like name, right? Like we will obsess over like the name and, you know, naming is the hardest problem in computer science. And so, you know, if that's the case, then, you know, APIs, which are sort of like a bundle or a basket of names, you know, by definition is like combinatorially more difficult. But I think it's incredibly important. Like you both want to make your API very approachable for new users mm-hmm. naturally. And then, you know, maybe increasingly you want to make your API approachable for new AIs.
There's a lot of like really great insight that you are sharing. And I want to share this hot take. This level of perfectionism and this level of attention to detail, sometimes it could borderline mean like toxicity.
Mm.
within the company culture? How do you make sure that that's nicely balanced? Because, you know, if you set yourself a goal of finding imperfections, you will find them, right? So where does that stop? And how do you make sure that the culture at Chroma is still thriving and healthy and not toxic?
I think toxic cultures really only evolve when people have the strong opinion that they are right. That's different than having the strong opinion that we should find the right answer. And so, you know, we try to hire people, I think we succeed at hiring people that have like relatively low egos, like for their own ideas. And, you know, they're really invested in the pursuit of truth and like finding the very best possible, you know, solution in any given problem or name. And, you know, one of our like values is a phrase we use sometimes called look for surprises. And I think that that disposition of like, you know, I'm in this meeting not to prove myself correct. And this meeting, this disposition of like, I'm open and ready and willing to be surprised by ostensibly being wrong in some way or not having perfect information, that that is a value which helps with this. I will also say that I think that like anything great is ultimately built by a small team of opinionated people. And so like, I do not think that you can build something great by a large team. I do not think, and obviously large companies can be composed of smaller teams. So it's not about the company size. I do not think you can build something great by being a large team. I do not think you can build something great by having unopinionated people. And so, you know, you sort of just, I think the only, again, the only way to do this is this way. And like, you see this in like a lot of open source projects, right? Yeah. Like, you know, there's many, you know, you can just reference like, you know, Linux itself, right? You know, it is maintained by a small group of like highly opinionated people. And this is why it is like so great. And like, if it was like one large decision by committee, it would be a train wreck. And so, you know, I think that like the desire for consensus, whilst intuitively egalitarian and, you know, sort of feels good, actually is like a death blow for many projects.
I mean, it sounds almost like a controversy to be opinionated and to be excited about being wrong in a way, you know, because it's like you open yourself up for discovery and learning about other opportunities, which could be better than what you had in mind originally. But it's an interesting take. And I actually invite our listeners to take this as a takeaway from this conversation, because I think it's liberating in a way to think about projects like that.
Yeah, it makes sense that like, it, you know, maybe on a rational basis, it's hard to do both at once. I agree. Yeah. The benefit is that humans are not very rational. And so, you know, I think we can actually embody like this like superposition or like the synthesis of like both being opinionated about like, I think this is the best way, and also being open to, you know, other ways of other ways.
So when you founded Chroma, you had already had experience building a startup from scratch, right? And also growing inside Mighty Hive from engineer to like head of product, right? Were there some lessons that you were surprised to learn when you founded Chroma? Like, was there something like a revelation that you found, especially in the early days, you know, especially when you shared that there was some skepsis about vector databases and like people didn't quite understand what it means, and perhaps retaining that certainty in the product was like hard. Yeah. Were there any lessons that came up?
I mean, yeah, I've been working kind of as a part of various startups for some time. And so I think that like, you know, I brought obviously a lot of mistakes that I've made into the past, like into this company. And I think as a result, we're able to like also avoid a bunch of mistakes, which is good. We got both, I would say, lucky, but also we were kind of like in the right time, right place, right team, kind of in the early days of like search and retrieval and RAG and everything else. And, you know, as a result, like the project just in the earliest days, like grew like wildfire and, you know, is now used by like tons of teams. I was just on a trip to New York meeting with a bunch of like large financial institutions. And, you know, they're just telling me things like, yeah, we have like, you know, thousands of engineers that use and love Chroma. And like, you know, this is like kind of blowing my mind, honestly, like even just last week. And so like, you know, it's obviously downstream of like catching fire in the earliest, days. And it's not, you know, that's not the destiny for all, obviously, open source projects. Some open source projects take, you know, many years to kind of reach that like breakout period. But like, I would say that like, if something surprised me, it was, I think I had like known that such a thing existed in theory, but like the feeling of that thing was like very cool and different and new.
let's talk about open source for a bit. Was it tough for you to understand what part of the project should be open sourced, or how did you in general, like what was your strategy about the open source component of your product?
I think for data infrastructure, it's usually pretty straightforward, at least for like OLTP shaped data infrastructure, which like search is like an OLTP shaped workload. You know, OLAP maybe is different. We can always talk about that if you're interested, but like for OLTP, like it kind of just has to be open source to be very successful. Developers have to start on their local computers. Large enterprises have to have the continuity story and the security story of it being open source. Mm-hmm. And like, there's just kind of no way around it. And you're backing, you know, a live application. And so it's not like an OLAP database where like, oh, the query was slow, whatever, you know, or, oh no, like the query failed, retry it. Like, you know, like a live database for it's backing real end users. Like it just has to work. It has to be very reliable. And so we kind of always knew that it should be open source. It shouldn't be fake open source. So it shouldn't be some weird license that has a bunch of hair on it. Yeah, it should be sort of MIT or Apache 2 or BSD 2 or 3 clause. And we went with Apache 2.
Yeah.
And then we also believe that like, you know, other people do weird stuff where they like, oh, like the data plane is open source, but the control plane is closed source. But you don't find that out till later. Gotcha, you know? And like, as you want to go beyond a single node distributed, well, sorry, you got to like pay us money now. And like, I don't know. I just think that like, that's a short-term optimization, not a long-term optimization. Yeah. And I think like, I've always wanted to like build the biggest company in the long term. And like, that means playing for the long term. And so like Chroma is 100% open source. The database is all Apache 2. It's all in our Mono repo on GitHub. You can see everything. There's not like a secret indexing algorithm that we've not open sourced or anything like this. It's open source. And again, that's not true for a lot of our competitors. So that being said, I don't think it makes sense for everything to always be open source. Open source is a large commitment to your community.
Yeah.
You are, I see open source as making a real commitment to your community that you will be a good steward of this project.
Yeah.
You will take in their feedback. You will address their bugs. Even when these users are not paying you any money, right? Like you will continue to improve the project, keep it up to date, handle security, all of these things. And so like, in some ways, you do want to be thoughtful about the surface area of things that you open source.
Yeah.
And you know, not everything should be open source as a result. You also want to be able to move quickly and at certain times. And like, you know, if you have a database, well, you can't really move that quickly. You have to think about backwards compatibility and migrations and make sure that like that's easy for users as well. And so long story short, like we've always been committed to like the engine that is the database is open source. It's Apache 2. Again, there's no gotchas, no tricks. That being said, I think that like we are okay with the idea of like the car being commercial. The car like sits around the engine. And so, you know, I think a lot of people just want cars. Like they want to get in the car, turn the key, go from point A to point B. I don't have to think about the engine. They want to bring other people with them in the car and collaborate. They want to turn on the radio and the AC and the heated seats. And like, you know, they want the accoutrements and like workflows and like, you know, obviously, in practice, this is like, you know, auditing and security and auth and all this stuff, right? Like seeing their data and editing their data and like all this stuff. And like, you know, in our mind, that was like a good thing. That was a thing that we thought was made sense to not make open source. Again, not because like we're being like overly greedy with it. Maybe we will open source it someday, but like we needed ultimately our team needed like velocity on that thing.
Yeah.
And if you're open sourcing it, you're opening yourself up to the community giving input, which is great. But also in practice, it's going to make the thing go slower. And so we needed like a lot of velocity. Anyways, this is how we thought about it. Yeah. This analogy of like engine and car, we've been extremely clear about like from day one, both with our user base and with our team. And like, I think there's never, ever been a problem at all. And, you know, this is on our about page and we'll be on our about page forever. Like we are committed to making Chroma the ubiquitous open source solution in this category. And I think you can't half-ass it, you know? Like you have to stay true to that. So
do you find that your open source users and your car users are the same people?
Yeah, that's the interesting part about like what we're doing as well is that they are extremely overlapping and like, you know, I would say like for commercial open source, like there's like monetizing data, monetizing compute and monetizing config.
Yeah.
And monetizing config and compute, like you can start to have some like weird moral hazard that happens and like, it's not always like super aligned with your community and it can just be awkward, you know?
Yeah.
I think what's interesting about like monetizing data is like our users from day one have asked us for a fully hosted managed service mm-hmm. from day one. And it took us a while to build it because we believed in building it the right way. But now, you know, that is live. It's like growing very fast and, mm-hmm. and users just like love it, which is awesome. And like, you know, we're not forcing you to use our service, right? Like no. you can run distributed Chroma yourself. You can use single node Chroma yourself. Increasingly, we actually are running Chroma because it's as simple as like a Rust binary. We're also putting it inside of Swift to run on iPhones and putting it inside of Android to run inside of, you know, Android devices. And like we're working on maybe in the next month or two, releasing it so you can run it in the browser yeah. or in a node process and like just like anywhere, right? Like anywhere that you want to search and retrieve, you should be able to do so mm-hmm. across like edge devices, you know, serverless functions, you know, single node servers or distributed clusters. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and our belief is that like most users will benefit from not managing their own infrastructure. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the very best infrastructure, who runs the infrastructure the best? It's the people that like, you know, design the infrastructure. So. Yeah.
So at this stage of the product where you have already found your product market fit, right? Like things are going smoothly. How do you prioritize your feature list or how do you think about your roadmap? Mm. You obviously have your 10-year mission in mind, yeah. but those stepping stones are ever changing and who plays into making those decisions?
You know, one way to think about the decision matrix is for a database like Chroma, people are choosing across a variety of factors. And this could be speed, cost, reliability, operational complexity, scalability, and accuracy, mm-hmm. to name a few. So, you know, we naturally think about like, okay, are we already best in class on speed? Are we best in class on cost? Obviously, mm-hmm. those two are tightly related. You can usually spend more money to go faster, but not people don't always want to spend more money to go faster. And so some sort of like, you know, Pareto optimal point for, yeah. you know, the speed to cost ratio. For things like operational reliability and stability, this is like something we've invested a ton in. And like, I think I'm very proud to say that like versus maybe like the search infrastructure that came before Chroma, mm-hmm. like Chroma is truly like zero config, zero knobs to tune. It just works. And like people love that. And like, we've had stories from customers where like their launch goes really well and like their Postgres falls over and like their compute orchestration framework falls over. But like Chroma just keeps, you know, chugging away, you know, no problems at all. And like, obviously that makes us really like happy to hear, but like we designed it to do that. And so that's not an accident, right? That's not mm-hmm. that's not unintentional. So I think this is the framework that we use or one of the frameworks we use. You know, I also think that we view the job to be done as not like, and this is maybe a bit of a heterodox take, but like, I think the job to be done is not quote building a database mm-hmm. actually. I mean, like that's what people like think they want to buy. They want to buy like a database or they want to buy data infrastructure, and that's fine. I'm happy to like use the terms people like want. Mm-hmm. But I think actually deep down, like developers want to solve a certain type of problem. And it just so happens that for this type of a problem, you need to build it, you need to test it, mm-hmm. you need to deploy it, you also need to monitor it, and then you also need to iterate it. And it ends up feeling a little bit more like software in a sense, because again, like the data that's being retrieved is the programming of your context window, as we discussed. And so like it is kind of, it shares, it's not just like a database yeah. life cycle. It's sort of SDLC adjacent as well. Mm-hmm. And so I think like thinking about like the developer workflows that are required to building really great search systems and retrieval systems, you should think about it in that loop. And then, you know, obviously there's, I think, a lot to do in enabling developers to do that. And so we're still early, I would say, like broadly in that arc, mm-hmm. but we are working on a variety of features to help developers like run that loop through very quickly and efficiently, and mm-hmm. increasingly AI itself like use that loop. So that's one. And then there's like a little bit of like skate to where the buck is going. You know, you can't always be purely reactive to your customers. You know, they'll always ask for a faster horse, which is great. We also, you know, try to think about like what is the future of kind of AI search and mm-hmm. you know, what parameters need to be in place. No one's thinking about today, but like everybody will be thinking about 6 months from now. And so we have our theses there, but you know, those may be still some secrets. So
what is your stance on fundraising?
I think you should fundraise when you have a good idea of how to go faster. And you should fundraise probably more than you think you need. Like you don't get points for like shaving pennies. You get points for winning the big prize at the end of the rainbow. Yeah. And like you shouldn't raise funding if you're not going after a big prize. Like VCs don't care at all if you're going after a small prize. I think the other way to think about funding is like fundraising is every stage of the company, you're trying to prove something.
Yeah.
And you can't prove everything at once, which is just, you know, natural. And so like thinking about fundraising in terms of like milestones of like, you know, for this milestone, like what are the things we need to prove?
Yeah.
And then you prove those things. And once you've proved those things, you've both proved to the investors, but you've also proved to yourself that there's like something here. And then like, that's the natural point to go and like raise more and go faster.
I guess my final question would be, what do you think is still missing in AI tooling in general? Like what are some big gaps that you're seeing? Just to give our listeners ideas on what areas to pursue.
Yeah, it's somewhat difficult. I think that like one simplistic way to think about AI is ultimately just like reasoning plus search.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, the labs are working on perfect reasoning. We're working on perfect search. I think that a lot of the stack will get hoovered up by kind of the reasoning side and the search side, basically. And like even opportunities that look interesting today, you know, could become marginalized as a result.
Yeah.
I mean, if I was a developer, I probably would like work more on the application side than the infra side or the tooling side.
Yeah.
Again, like open source is like really hard to commercialize a lot of the time, like really hard. I think there's a lot of like interesting questions around like what massive scale agent inference will look like.
Mm-hmm.
And so this means like, you know, today we run like one agent, then talks to one agent, talks to one agent. But like in the future, it could be like one agent kicks off a job across 10,000 agents.
Yeah.
And then like another agent judges which out of those 10,000 was the best. This has actually been shown to be very effective in research and academia. And like, there's just a lot of like pretty interesting like compute orchestration problems.
Yeah.
That like, you know, obviously you have like the GPUs themselves as a constraint, all the bottlenecks they're in. And so like, I think there's like an interesting opportunity for a new kind of like distributed inference execution platform. And I think that like that probably could be open source, but then, you know, running that system would also be fairly complex. And so then like maybe owning that system, you know, offering a service around that system, you could monetize that.
Mm-hmm.
But it's very hard to know, you know, it's very hard to know.
I like to end my conversations with one question. And I think here it's most fitting because by the sound of it, you love what you do. Like, Chroma sounds like a product of love very much. Mm. And I think users also second that, right?
Mm.
So you get a lot of kind of like love in response to that.
Mm.
My final question is what I called a warm fuzzy question. What makes you feel great about what you're doing today?
I think like the bull case in my mind for AI is, you know, yeah, maybe it'll cure cancer and whatever, all this like crazy stuff. And I don't know, like, it just seems like that still seems like mostly a pipe dream. I believe in pipe dreams are great to believe in, but like, it's mostly a pipe dream. I do think that AI can lead to like the democratization of services though. It seems like very clear that like even the models of their current capabilities is like entirely possible. So like you can offer world-class education, medical services, financial services, legal services, et cetera, like to anybody for pennies. And I think there's like, that is going to be like extremely impactful and beneficial to like all of humanity. And so like, you know, maybe like, you know, when you build a tool, you can't always control how it will be used. You know, you build a hammer, right? Hammer's been used for a lot of good stuff, always bad stuff too. You know, I don't know, like read the news. And so, you know, you can't always control how it's used, obviously, but like, you know, it always is exciting to me when I see, you know, customers using our technology to like, you know, it's a cliche, but like, you know, make the world a better place. That's very motivating.
Finally, I want to provide space for you to invite people to try Chroma. How can they find it? Where should they start?
Totally, yeah. If you type Chroma into Google, it'd be the top result. And
hopefully. No, I'm joking.
Usually is, yeah. or T-R-Y, Chroma, trychroma.com. And you can sign up. You get $5 in free credits, no credit card. You can load in some sample data. I think that $5 is equivalent to like 100,000 documents and 100,000 queries. So it's actually like a pretty, like, it's like actually quite a bit. And yeah, just experience. I think like how easy we make search and retrieval. Like, it doesn't have to be hard anymore. So.
Awesome. It was a pleasure. I really hope that everybody else who is listening also will enjoy it and watching because we're in this amazing studio. Thank you for hosting me and thank you for coming to my podcast.
Thanks for the time. This is great.
Thank you for catching yet another episode of Dev Propulsion Labs. We at Evil Martians transform growth stage startups into unicorns, build developer tools, and create open source products. If your developer tool needs help with product design, development, or SRE, visit evilmartians.com/devtools.
See you in the next.